Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
You want to bow?
Okay, we will bow. Oh, one more.
I need a chair for him.
Oh, there's a chair.
I got a chair here.
Oh, you got one?
Thank you.
Save
the
one
This is Module 7, What Makes You Not a Buddhist? Talk 2, Impermanence. So we're getting a lot of kickback on this book, which is really great. It means I don't have to say very much. And we've taken a good look at him, and we think he's pretty sturdy and can handle all the kickback he's getting. So, first of all, I think it's worth saying that this is a book about what's called view. That is, the four seals are a view. They are not about practice. This book, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, doesn't give you any practice. Now, that doesn't mean it's not about practice, but we've been providing practice all along, and the view has to be done in the light of practice. We've talked about basic shamatha instruction. We've had a whole series of working with emotions using a text by Pundup Rinpoche. And then we did the Lojong teachings and the practice of Tonglin. And by the way, it's our intention to keep practicing Tonglin during the hour of meditation. So we will be doing that. And when you deal with something like what is the view, don't forget the practice. We've had all these practices. Don't take this in a vacuum. I brought along the two books on Tonglen in case anyone wants to go look for it and find a slogan that might be useful. So first of all, some people felt that maybe, Rinpoche is making fun of us or insulting us. Does anyone feel that way at this point? He is a trickster. We've seen it. How many people have seen this movie by now?
Which movie are we talking about?
Travelers and Magicians.
Oh, yeah.
How many people have seen it? Okay, plenty. Okay. So he seems, in a sense, to be making fun of a young man who is going to go off to America to pick apples instead of being a fairly respected person in his own town. And then a new element comes along, that there's a beautiful young lady who really is in love with him. And we know he's had women on his mind a lot, because we've seen all the porn in his personal bedroom, for example. So is he making fun of someone, saying, why are you going off to pick apples in America? Well, this guy, Dzongtsar Khyentse Rinpoche, is a trickster. He can appear a little bit insulting, but what is he insulting? Us or all the foibles that all humans have? Does anyone want to say anything about that?
I thought it was kind of funny.
You saw the movie?
No,
you haven't.
His writing.
Oh, okay. You like his writing style.
Yeah, I think it's rather dry humor, and it kind of lightens it up, and got a couple chuckles out of it.
There are a lot of chuckles about it. And he's talking about all sorts of strange things and practices that people do and things they spend money on or go out of their way to accomplish, which seem kind of silly when you shine some light on them. Yeah.
I like how he brings up the idea of how everything just keeps running in cycles. You know, this country and this country are getting along, and then, you know, years later they don't, and then they're back to liking each other again, and it does show the impermanence of all of this. You know, and when something's in fashion and then it's not, and why are this kind of person attractive now and now it's not, and, you know, it's just constantly cycling through to how we get in our head a certain concept in a certain state, and then it goes away.
I like that. He laughed at himself, if you come back to laughing. For example, he talked about the generalizations and sort of examples of what you just talked about. And then in the very next sentence, he says, and of course, this book is filled with generalizations.
I missed you. Say that loud.
He used a lot of examples of other societies or people using generalizations, which make life absurd. And yet, the very next sentence, he says, and of course, you can expect plenty of generalizations from me.
From me, yeah, right. And another place, not in this book, he gave a talk in which he said, you know, talking to Americans, you really cannot be Tibetans, which needed to be said, actually, because some Americans act like they maybe want to be Tibetans. And then he said, but this is amazing here. I'm steeped in Buddhism because I was brought up in this Tibetan system. I was bathed in it since I was 2 or 3 years old. You went out and found it in the midst of your complicated, confusing, materialistic culture. You went out and found it. That's amazing. And he said that about us. And it's a tribute of some sort, too. So there's a lot of little things going on in the ripples of his humor, I think.
I keep finding myself some sort of offended by things he would say, but at the same time, in the big picture, I thought it was great. So, like, some of the details I can't recall in right now, but I would read anything.
Do you have one?
Where was the editor? But then, you know, I get what he's saying. I think it's very wise.
But is that part of his, like, how you get people thinking? Like, we used to say to people, you're great because you study Buddhism and it's so nice and you're wonderful people. Let's, like, where's the practice in that? You know, that's expecting applause. Good for you.
Expecting applause, okay.
I thought the overall message was good. I like the way he leaves in the Siddhartha story.
Pardon?
I like how he leaves in the Siddhartha story to this. And I haven't gotten very far through the second chapter.
He talks a lot of, so he says he's making generalizations. He's also telling stories, right? In other words, a lot of it, he does it by telling a story, telling it as if it's Siddhartha's story, which I find a little questionable. In some cases, it's some other teacher's story, actually. But because we don't know too much about what Siddhartha said and didn't say. We just don't have records going back to him very well. There was another way in which we got a lot of kickback, and that was all emotions are pain, even the pleasurable ones. And there was a lot of disagreement on that, wasn't there? And it's centered on, by the way, this is the second seal, so we're really going to deal with it in the next class, but it did come up rather strongly. So I started looking at it very carefully. I looked at that chapter. And in the end, the question is joy painful? And the answer has got to be, if it's genuine joy, no. It's not painful because it's not produced. He said all conditioned pleasure and all conditioned pain are painful. In other words, anything we bring about because we want to have pleasure comes under that category. So if you think back to previous courses, we had the technical term klesha. He doesn't want to use any words like that. But we use the word klesha to mean any emotion which has to do with me. Me. It's my pain, it's my pleasure, it's my wanting, it's my hating, whatever. So if there's intense pleasure and it's brought about by the beautiful blue sky, maybe that's completely beyond me. But if we find we're clinging to it, then it's a little different. Does that make sense?
Well, it's kind of like the Siddhartha story where he's sitting under the Bodhi tree and, you know, things are coming up. Just the presence of them coming up is actually a blessing.
Yeah.
Because it was something that he could choose to engage in or not, or make peace with, or whatever, however you want to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So the presence of it is not a bad thing. So to me, sometimes if I have some sort of emotion that comes up, it's an opportunity. I don't look at it as automatically being a bad thing or painful. It's an opportunity to work with it.
But painful is different than suffering.
Yeah, but he used the word pain. Emotion is pain. Is that what the title was of that?
That's what the title is. The title of the third chapter is, yes, emotion and pain. But of course he makes a distinction. I mean, I think what you're saying is actually very appropriate, because we actually learn as we go forward that we're not trying to get rid of anything.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually engaging with all experiences in terms of understanding the true nature. So even our neurotic outbursts or klesha attacks or any kind of afflictive arising is actually going to be understood as fundamental Buddha nature. This is where we're going with this, with these practices and studies. But fundamentally where we start with is fundamentally recognizing our experiences that we are attached to are fundamentally pain. And that's a simple way to put it. I mean, it is very provocative. And it doesn't leave you a lot of wiggle room.
When I met with Michael this week, because I was so disturbed about this book, I met my cousin. I think I was thinking of what you said before about if it's all about me, then, you know, everything's, it's all about me, it's all about me, then even though it's something to work with, who's to decide what's genuine joy? Well, your joy is, you know, genuine, but yours is not. This is a crappy self-centered joy. So I think Michael said, you know, nobody's to say that about anybody else.
Wait, I put up a slogan. Do you remember which one?
Oh, I forget.
Of the two witnesses,
yes.
Take the principal one.
Yes.
In other words, you're the one who knows truthfully what's happening to you,
yeah,
if you're honest about it.
Yes.
And you may find yourself going against societal convention, or you may not, but you know whether something is genuine within yourself.
So what's the sort of converse of this? So we're talking about whether true joy is really painful, but what about What about the reverse of that? When is unhappiness pure as opposed to, confounded with grasping and so forth? So is there pure unhappiness and that's different somehow from manufactured unhappiness?
At some point it said, now pain and pleasure are adornments which it's delightful to wear, which means when we are genuinely at the point of not choosing, of not trying to select our experience, but taking every experience as it happens, then it's not about me. And the pain and the pleasure are not a problem.
So separating the circumstances from the emotional response to it. So I guess what I'm getting at, just to be extreme about it, would be loss of a loved one, where you have a genuine grief situation. And is the idea then that's pure grief, just as there's pure joy, and yet it can get kind of out of control to the point where it's a level of suffering that's no longer pure, it's wrapped up in neuroses or something. Is that the idea?
Well, how do you feel about it?
Well, that seems like it's the case to me, that there's a distinction between being genuinely unhappy about something awful and then the suffering that you can add on to that through.
Right, okay.
It's like the first arrow versus the second arrow kind of thing.
The first arrow
is just the painful experience, and the second arrow is all the crap that you load on yourself about your response to the painful experience and how awful it is and all that stuff.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. So if emotion is pain, I'm a scientist, so I have to have this be true, that it's true in one circumstance, it has to be true in all circumstances for us to accept it as true. So if it's true for joy, it has to be true for pain also.
Well, that's good thinking. Buddhism is basically science with all personal orientation removed.
Okay.
Most scientists have a big ego investment in their science, right? But if you have pure science without ego investment, then you've got Buddhism.
That's pretty steep grade, because science assumes that the observer is completely neutral,
mm-hmm.
which is extremely unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
And so the observer is bringing their own prejudices. In fact, if you're a scientist, you know that actually the observer affects the field of observation.
Yeah.
This has actually been noted in experiments and verified, validated in those circumstances. So to actually see things as they are is a pretty high calling, meaning that the observer fundamentally is completely out of the way,
mm-hmm.
with absolutely no prejudice and no in any way conditions that would possibly affect the field of inquiry
or the interpretation. I hear what you're saying, having spent a long time in universities. Yeah. Recovering from that.
Einstein said that was impossible because we're always filtering everything through our nervous system. Like a frog will see black and white and it will see movement.
What you're saying is there is no objective reality. There's only perception as it happens to each sentient being, and that's true.
Yeah.
And that's very fundamental Buddhist thinking too.
Mm-hmm.
To notice that. So Buddhism does not teach an ultimate objective world, certainly, okay? There can't be such a thing. Buddhism is very good at demolishing it by pointing out how it fails us if we start to believe it. And I think maybe we're going to be touching on that later. So we've got four seals, and tonight we're talking about the first one. All compounded things are impermanent. So when we look at these four seals, they all have to do with non-self, the central issue of Buddhism. But they get harder as you take the four, I think, or at least up to the third one, they get harder, maybe the fourth one. So the first of these four seals is very easy to understand. It's so easy to understand that we have a opportunity to take a look at what this book is saying, because he does not say, to be a Buddhist, you must understand these four. What does he say?
Accept,
yeah, exactly. So what I'd like really to, as a way to get into this first one, we have this beautiful opportunity to look at this word accept, and I think that ought to be a key word for how we can have a discussion, because we have something here that's easy to understand, and do we accept it? Now, if you can't understand something, that's accepting it might be a little more complicated, but this is simple, isn't it? We're saying every compounded thing is impermanent, and compounded things include momentary thoughts, emotions, animals, rocks, humans, planets, universes, whatever scale you want. Everything comes into existence from certain causes and conditions, and then when those aren't present, it's no longer there. That's pretty clear, right? Any human life is like that. It comes about for various reasons, and it ends for various reasons. Many reasons, all kinds of complicated reasons. So another hook into this is called codependent origination, which is everything that comes into existence because it has multiple causes. And if you think of your own body and life, why you exist, if you start to look for things that caused it to happen, you see that there are so many that you can't account for them, you can't possibly know them. One of them could be that your great-grandfather looked at some woman rather than another woman who he might have seen the next day, right? And if that hadn't happened, you wouldn't exist. But even if he ended up marrying the woman who was your great-grandmother, supposing they were making love and they were lying in a slightly different position, then a different one of millions of sperm would have been the one to fertilize an egg of the next generation. And then everything would be different. But this applies to just one thing we can talk about, but everything that comes along starts to make differences, and those differences spread. And they spread all over this world at least, and maybe they spread to other planets. We don't even know. We know certainly that some things have spread as far as the moon and Mars, because we've sent something out there which has produced a cause out there. So everything in the world comes into existence because of previous causes, and it persists because of present conditions. Each of us can be here and alive because the room happens to have oxygen in it. We didn't have a severe earthquake here collapsing this particular building. It happened somewhere else. So everything is contingent. On the other hand, any one of us could have been killed coming to class and might be killed going home. So we live in a world of total transience of conditional things. Anyone disagree with that? No, we're all convinced. You couldn't argue against that, right? It's of the four seals, it's the simplest to understand. So now what I'd like for us to try to work on is, what does it mean to accept this first seal? All conditioned things are impermanent. Or if that's too hard, you do exactly what Jemyin Kensei Rinpoche does. He puts it around. What does it mean not to accept? What does it mean not to accept that you're not even in control of your own thoughts? You don't know where they come from. You don't know what's happening with them. You don't know which one will become coming up next, or whether you will get distracted. Or your life could end at any time. And we're growing old. Our bodies are changing. We will end, unless something kills us off fast, we're going to end up going through something painful. Maybe we will have dementia. There are people we care about very much who are going to get sick, get old, die, who we care about. You were having this discussion, I think, just before class started, so that's basically what I think we could be talking about tonight. What does it mean not to accept that all conditioned things are impermanent? Yeah?
The tact I'd like to take on it is it's an assumption. And the analogy we take would be like a mathematics that says the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. Now, until somebody like Einstein comes along and says, well, we'll consider curved surfaces, then we have to modify that assumption. So, to me, the views, they're assumptions to error then. And until some other, you know, guru comes along and sort of expands on it, it doesn't necessarily annihilate it. It just, you know, would modify it. I think, to me, the notion is that it's an assumption. So if with that assumption you back further into, well, is there a primary cause? Yeah, in other words, you're saying compounded factors. And somebody says, well, let's talk about the prime factors. Then you're into another assumption, because you'll never be able to verify it. And it may help you accept, you know, something. But accept means that you say it's absolutely true, like some people say God.
I think you've got to get very personal in order to deal with this question. What does it mean not to accept that you're growing old and going to die?
Yeah, so I'm saying it's an assumption.
Does that make you happy, that it's an assumption?
It makes me tolerant of the situation I'm in.
It does.
Yeah, absolutely. Rather than clouding it over with an assertion.
It provides you consolation or facing something bravely, or not adding more luggage in your head about the pain of what's happening. Does that theory really help you?
Yeah, I'm saying yes, it does.
Oh, okay.
So, because all those are judgment terms, and it helps me get away from unhappiness, happiness, consolation. They're all judgments. And if I can avoid judgments, because they don't lead anywhere, except with these four views, which give a great paradigm.
Suppose you go to the doctor and he says, you've got cancer and you're going to die in 6 months. Is this of use to you, this theorizing you're doing now?
At today's age, no. I go to anatomy.
What?
I'd go to a naturopathist.
What would that do?
It would give me a working solution, whereas present cancer theories are worthless.
You mean this guy's going to cure you?
It's a poor example.
What?
It's an ineffective example.
It's an ineffective... I don't get it.
I feel you're talking about something else. I'm not sure.
I don't want to talk too much.
You're in a different area than this is. I don't know.
Well, an assertion to me is an assumption. That's all I'm really saying.
This is something that you need to validate these things for yourself. It's not like we're supposed to just swallow them whole because someone who seems to be in a position of authority says it's this way. And the Buddha historically never told people to believe what he says. He always said, go find out for yourself. I mean, the question of impermanence and compounded, or Michael mentioned the word co-arising or codependent, or it's also called interdependent, is that everything is arising as a complex coming together of various circumstances.
I'm trying to hold a discussion too. I don't think there's anyone here who believes they're immortal or that there's some magic that's going to protect them from getting old and dying. What does it mean to accept or not accept? You've got to get down onto the pavement and smear yourself on it instead of staying in some theory realm.
Well, I think the accepting part is what they say, you know, there's like 4,000 sayings about this, that everyone believes everyone will die except for themselves.
Sorry to interrupt you. Is there still a tree on a route for? I mean, I put up a light on the inside.
A what?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. I think there's that piece of trying to imagine. I mean, I just remember when I was a little kid, I thought about, like, somehow I think I remember that I thought I would be under a tree and be under the ground under a tree and be dead. And then what would I know? And sort of not, you know, as a 10-year-old, not being able to think like that didn't make sense to me because I couldn't imagine it when I was that old. And I'm not sure I still, that part of imagining. Like, I'm here, I'm thinking, I'm talking, you know, I may go through this decline, but that to imagine that point where, there's all these transitions in your life, that's the real transition, and I can't imagine it.
Yeah, I think that's true for all of us. Our imagination does not extend to our own death. We can't imagine what it's like not to be here, right?
Right.
But we all know that everyone, including ourselves, is going to die. Yes?
You posed the original question, what would happen if you didn't believe in impermanence?
No. If you didn't accept it.
Accept it.
Accept it. Okay, everyone here has sort of acknowledged, I think, that they realize they aren't going to live forever.
Right.
Everyone knows that.
I think, though, that there are people who don't accept it. And the predominant feeling there is a belief that they can actually control the outcome of something, that they can plan enough around all of the contingencies that X will lead to Y. And that causes a great deal of anxiety in people because they believe that if they can do all their perfect planning, they'll get the right outcome. And that's, I think, the source of a lot of people's issues today. It's a lot of suffering because when they receive the news that they have cancer, there's a lot of denial that's involved at first, part of the process to finally towards acceptance. But initially there's a lot of a denial and people go to great lengths to disprove the idea that they actually have cancer. More opinions, and I'm not saying they shouldn't do those things, it's just that we do go through a process of denial because the very first thing in our head is this can't be happening. And so my thought is that if you don't accept that seal, then you're going to go through a lot of your life thinking that you actually do have control over the outcome of situations, and that can be terribly anxious.
Okay, but going beyond intellectually believing it, which I think we've convinced ourselves is the case, just saying, how do we handle that personally? I think that's what the accepting is. It's not easy, is it?
No.
In other words, we're talking about ourselves here, not someone who has some unrealistic notion that we don't buy into.
We're swimming against the current. I mean, if you don't accept it, you're resisting everything that is.
But everybody swims
against the
current.
All of us.
You are dead.
What, pardon?
I mean, otherwise we'd be dead. We'd just be floating down the river like a piece of, like, an inanimate object. I mean, a lot of the activities that we partake in to forestall our inevitable demise are productive things, like having children, making a living, developing or fostering relationships. You know, I mean, there's some balance, I think, but I mean, if I just threw up my hands and said, well, I'm going to die anyway.
Is that what you understand by acceptance?
No, it's not.
Okay.
But I think there's, it can get confused with acceptance.
Okay, so, yeah,
what were you going to say?
Well, so personally, I have this situation. I accept impermanence. Who wouldn't, right? But I don't necessarily believe it, because it takes a lot of practice. And here's a personal example. So in my business, I'll often see people who I haven't seen for 5 or 10, 15 years or something, old clients or something. So I'll go up to them, and I'll look at them and interact with them, and I'll be thinking while they're talking, this person's getting old. And yeah, like they're getting old and I'm the same.
Okay.
Right.
You know? So
yeah.
And then of course I think, wait a second, you know, but it's very slight. It goes past quickly. Well, I must be getting old too. Just miss that. So I guess my point is you can accept it, but without really diligently practicing and observing impermanence, I think it's easy not to believe it.
Okay, you turned what I said upside down. Okay, interesting.
It sounds like we can accept it intellectually, but emotionally.
We're talking about emotionally here, right?
We don't accept it emotionally, maybe. No. Because we can't imagine.
But to dial it back a little bit, so you're asking for personal reactions to this, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I wasn't thinking about dying as I was reading this. I was just thinking about today. And I thought it was really liberating. Mm-hmm. You know, because crap happens and you think, God, my day's ruined. But it's not ruined. It's just that something happened. And we've had a situation in my family that's been very difficult and has gone on for a long time. But you know, when you think about it and say, but it's not going to go on forever, that's actually wonderful. That's wonderful news. So I thought there was a huge upside to this. It was great. The craft doesn't last, and I mean, that's what the good stuff bears too.
Well, that's a very useful point.
Yeah, I thought it was great. It happened to me. I accepted it, and I believe it.
Maybe too easy, but okay. I think we got to dig deeper into how we actually behave.
Well, that's actually a switch from accepting to applying.
Right.
Applying actually the understanding that comes through accepting.
Does anybody else? I mean, I don't. Maybe I'm weird or something. But does anybody else ever think about, like, oh, I could die today, or, I mean, I think about that stuff all the time.
I actually make a point when people say, see you tomorrow, I always say, that's the plan.
Yes, in fact, Buddhism keeps coming back to this, okay? So, I mean, we hear a story of a Zen master who every day cleans his teacup and turns it upside down because he doesn't know if he's going to wake up in the morning. So he's doing exactly what you're doing. He's taking it completely personally that we don't know what's going to happen.
I do that every day when I leave the house. I'll put things in order because I don't know.
Mm-hmm. When I say goodbye to my children, it's the same thing. When they walk out the door, I make sure that I tell them I love them because we don't know.
So keeping impermanence in mind actually provides some happiness, doesn't it? It reminds us that
how precious this moment
is. Yeah, that, exactly, yeah, right.
But the thought of finding it liberating is impermanent.
I'm sorry that you have to speak a little louder if I'm going to catch it.
Just saying that the whatever thought, whatever emotion you have about impermanence is impermanent.
Mm-hmm.
So you could, I often, one of the ways I try to figure out if I've learned something or understand it is I envision having to explain it to someone. And, you know, so if I try to explain to, one of my nieces or nephews or colleagues or whatever, the concept of impermanence, how would I say that? And I think that their emotion about it would be dependent upon where they were in their life at that moment, at that time, in that day.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be liberating on one day, and it might be curse on another day.
Mm-hmm.
Because however you feel about it is impermanent.
Okay. So my son's getting married, and if you want my opinion, it's the wrong time. I'm not sure it's the right woman. I think and I don't think he has the means to enter into this situation. That's my opinion. But my opinion doesn't matter because he's going to do it. So this is a...
It's okay, because marriage is impermanent.
Anything's
impermanent. Marriage is impermanent.
Yes, at least 53%.
Impermanence, right.
Now, the point to me is that accepting that it's going to happen... as opposed to putting any energy into fantasies of how I could change it when the situation is not changeable. So there's an element of acceptance taking us out of fantasy world and landing us right where things are happening, which I think is healthier and ultimately more genuinely happy.
I mean, this is the, like, that situation, you could either be liberated by the realization that you can't do anything about it, or it could be terrifying.
Couldn't be both.
Yeah.
I suppose it could be both. But less terrifying if you're focused, if you're able to work with the liberating part of it. I mean, that seems to be the gist of this, at least, it's sort of how you relate to things that happen in your life.
Keeps things very uncertain, but they are uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It doesn't keep them uncertain, it makes you aware of the uncertainty.
Yes, it makes me.
Helps you accepting it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just really, really hard, and I can't imagine being able to do it 100% of the time.
But even your opinion, to your point, could change and be impermanent. I mean, things may change. I mean, we may find in 5 years that they were wrong. Right?
It could work out, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you accept that, if you have an opinion today that, like you said, you know, you have the wisdom to say, I'm not going to step in with my opinion, I think part of that is a realization that your opinion may reflect what you see now, but that things change.
It could work out well.
Doesn't it have to change because nothing's permanent? Right? Your opinion is, or even you could just say, well, this is just a thought or emotion that will arise and then dissipate. It will go away at some point.
Or things will happen, and therefore I'll think something different.
Yeah.
I don't know what will happen, but something will happen, and I'll be in a different situation and have a different view. That's all.
So to sort of fix your opinion would be the thing we're all talking about not doing. Mm-hmm. Like to fix your opinion as to now you're going to change the way everything happens because you have this opinion. That would be the very non-Buddhist way.
It would be an unskillful way. And we're not talking about anything that's the property of Buddhism, by the way. These four seals are, I think, too thoroughly grounded in reality not to, in some sense, be realized by people of any religion or no religion or whatever. They are... They touch the earth, and that's sort of what I want to get at. We aren't dwelling in a land of theory here. Now, one of the things that can be emphasized is that one deals with pain, one deals with pleasure. Sometimes people are afraid to deal with pleasure. Afraid to touch it. And the point here is that one of the liberating things here is that we can thoroughly touch whatever it is, pain or pleasure. And not fear either.
Can we partially accept?
For everyone else.
I just don't know if I want to go all in. I mean, I like a little bit of delusion in my life, particularly around the death stuff.
It's more about being open and flexible when you encounter unanticipated situations. And as you were saying earlier, this notion of planning all the time or developing the notion of control is one of the biggest sources of anxiety, which, you know, and people feel like they're supposed to be in control because we're all led to believe that that's the right way to do things. We're supposed to be in control of our lives. But, you know, even when there's a degree of truth to the degree you have to take responsibility for your actions, and therefore you can have some control over how you deal with your thoughts. You may not control your thoughts entirely, but you can certainly work with it, coping with them instead of just letting them take you over, right? But I think that the issue of accepting impermanence is fundamental because otherwise we can't ever be realistic about. I mean, both my parents and I just did other personal homily or just an anecdote was that neither one of them would accept the fact they were going to die, and therefore they weren't giving any indications of what one should do. And since I was going to be, it was going to be dumped on me, you know, I had to basically say, hey, you know, you're going to ask me to do what I want, what I think is appropriate. So I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to give you a Buddhist burial. I'll have you cremated. How about that? And instantly they knew what they wanted.
That's good.
Never mind.
Now we'll tell you. Now we accept that level of promise.
When a number of years ago, my goddaughter had leukemia. She was just shy of 1 year old. And she passed away. I spent about 2 weeks in the hospital with her. And being her godmother, I felt like there was a role for me to play in that her parents were very much absorbed, of course, in trying to find a cure. I found for myself the experience of being with her was so much about being in the now. It was this little baby who has no concept of the future and what it holds for her. And at the same time that I was really navigating my grief, I was also finding a huge amount of beauty in this connection I had with this child who I knew wouldn't be with us for very long. And the change that that made for me in saying goodbye to my children each day they walk out the door and hugging them, and that moment feeling like this might be the last moment I see my children. And that was a great gift that was given to me in that moment, facing my goddaughter's death. What also surprised me was the number of people who were very good friends to this family who disappeared when they found out that the daughter was dying. And at first, I was angry about that. But then later I came to accept that they couldn't fathom the death of a child, because then they would look at their own children and go, oh my God, that could be my child. And then I had some compassion for that perspective, that's the greatest fear any parent has, speaking as a parent. But at the same time, for me, it brought me to a very different place about the process of death, so that years later when my dad died, I could be present with him and navigate those final moments with him. So for me, it was actually, like I said, it was that conflicting feeling of grief, and then also this beautiful moment that I got to be part of.
Right. And our compassion can get clogged by non-acceptance, can't it? It's not that it isn't there, but it gets suppressed and clogged, and we don't know how to work it. We don't see our own compassion. Is it that? I think that you're saying that.
Yeah.
So it's been 2.5 years since Emily had what was a minor heart attack from the point of view of the incident itself, followed by bypass surgery, which was a huge event because it's 6 months before you're even doing anything. But it was more painful for me than for her. And in some way, it was a huge lesson in acceptance that I couldn't make it go away. A situation which I had no idea. I thought she was in a healthy state, that, you know, because she was very athletic. And it came as a real shock. And crying was part of the acceptance for me. And Emily was more cheerful about it. But it did bring about a change, and it's the kind of change you've talked about. I don't leave her without, you know, thinking of how precious it is that she's here. When she goes on a journey, for example, which she is now.
Or a statement, these are really acute kind of situations where we're forced to face that kind of impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got to be true every day too, right? This has to be lived every day. And that's where I find it harder in a way, right? Because eventually you face, you know, these, you know, things you can't not face. But you know, taking the tea to visit a colleague and finding the meeting sort of going, that's got to be part of it. And that's, you know, so I wonder if I can bring this, see if this is an example of like a really tedious, quotidian kind of experience. I come away from meetings where I feel like I was supposed to be helping and I wasn't helping. I come away feeling like, oh, I did something wrong. I blew that. But you know, it was just fine. I think it was just fine. It has to be okay. But it's really hard to say that's not, it's not all me. I didn't do all that, right? That's where I don't accept it.
It's hard too, I think, because it's not like the rest of the world is also sitting in this room practicing these things. So if you're taking the tea to a meeting and the tea breaks down and you're late and you have all this anxiety because you're going to be late, and then your Buddhist side kicks in and you know, think happy thoughts and whatever, the meeting is impermanent, the tea is impermanent, I'm impermanent.
The tea's really impermanent.
The tea's very impermanent. But when you get to the meeting, your boss is pissed off because you're late. So, you know, what I struggle is practicing these things when the rest of the world isn't practicing them.
Mm-hmm. You know. We live in a very kind of tight-lipped state. And the whole Massachusetts is the East Coast Carter. Everybody is drilling into what they need to be doing right now. And it's got all kinds of done at a very high level. So I that's where I was coming from reading this. It was more like that. It was sort of easier to forgive those rough moments, and you know, to enjoy the good moments, maybe even more than I would normally, because I know they're not going to last.
But how do you deal with the moment when your boss is mad at you? Do you know what I mean? When it comes up that you have to interact with a world that it does not share the same beliefs that you.
I've been practicing, not knowing this book, I have actually been working on that issue for a long time, and I've learned at my advanced age to say, you're right, I could have done that differently or better, so let's talk about it.
It also seems like there's just a, this isn't about never having day-to-day experiences that are unpleasant or painful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's about knowing that those unpleasant and painful experiences aren't like a something that are going to brand you forever, and something that are going to carry around you forever. And sometimes when you're in that situation, that's what's the hardest thing about it. I blew that meeting, and because I blew that meeting, you know, it's going to put this and this at risk, and these people are going to think I'm this way forever.
I'm
you know, it's all that stuff. So it's just the kind of this too shall pass kind of thing that I think works really well in the day to day.
As at where I teach, something came up and I did deal with someone I have difficulty with anyway, and then everything she said to me, I was like, you know, like how you like, oh, stupid, like, no. And then I started someone after this, says, how are you doing? I said, I had a tough interaction. I didn't say with who, I didn't say what. So I've been really working. I'm trying to get to the point where I get rid of resentment in less than 20 years. Because I just know, like, there are people. And then I went and told someone a story, literally, that was from, like, 15 years ago when someone had disrespected me publicly. And I said, I could feel I was still angry. And I couldn't, you know, so some of that me, and, you're making my life miserable, or you're being mean to me. I didn't let go of it.
But the kind of drive all blames into oneself.
No, I drive them into these people.
One of the factors here that because we don't have control of all this experience, you may think you have blown an experience, which actually turns out to be a benefit. You missed a meeting because you were late, and as a result, something else fantastic developed there, which couldn't have happened with your presence. I mean, there's all kinds of other things that can happen. We don't know. We're talking about dealing with things exactly as they are when they come up, and rather than trying to anticipate and head off or ward off unpleasant or unwanted kind of situation. It's more about actually learning how to fully, and I think this is one of the things you brought up, is fully appreciating actually the situation which arises precisely as it is. And if it means your boss is getting mad at you and he's operating true to form, well, then, you know, that's part of what it means to live a precious life and actually just savor even the unpleasantness that comes up in those situations.
That's what I'm going to do the time I lost, because I want to save
your money. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to save money. Yeah, I'll get you.
There's misery again. But okay, so I'm sorry, that's a very cool idea, though. Right?
Awesome.
Just because it's so easy to, you know, our brains respond with, I am being threatened, right?
Yeah.
And it's so cool to see if we can find enough gap to say maybe it's not, maybe it's not. Yeah, I thought about that way.
That's true about, like, science experiments gone awry and it creates some cure for something else, you know, out of the mess, out of something that wasn't working. The same thing, you know, you make a film and you know, the scene doesn't go well, and then you cut it together in a different way, and all of a sudden they call it a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. You just don't know what's going to come out of the synergy of that so-called misstep.
I think another key thing is on the internet you see all these stories about horrendous acts of violence. And for me, when I read the story, obviously I'm empathizing with the victim. But there's all the times what I try to do is think, what caused that person to do that act of violence? What kind of pain is that person carrying inside of them that brought about where they could dehumanize people, be so just detached from their the outcome of what they're causing to happen? And I try to find in myself some empathy for the person who committed this violence, particularly difficult when it's violence against children. But I feel like if I can do that enough, that when I am in a situation with somebody who is yelling at me, particularly a person in a position of authority, I try to first, it's not always successful, sometimes it's an hour later, but I try to realize this is a person who's in pain. They're stressed out because I was late for the meeting, because their head is so wrapped around what's going on, and they see meeting on time, that meeting is integral to the outcome. And they believe that that one piece that's missing from that will cause the downfall. So they have this huge anxiety, and that's coming out in this huge regurgitation of anxiety and anger at the person in front of them, who they believe caused it. So I try to, when I'm in that situation, to say, wow, this person is in a huge amount of pain. And it's just a way of kind of triggering me to start to feel some empathy. And I think if I can practice on feeling empathy for somebody who committed an atrocious act of violence, it's probably a little easier to have empathy with a person who's yelling at me. Doesn't always.
I can do it from the person that's yelling at me. But I draw the line with violence against kids.
And what does that mean, you draw the line? You may be powerless to prevent it.
The whole concept of finding empathy for you know, someone that committed a kid's or the elderly, you know, finding empathy for. I always have the, for those of you that aren't from this area a long time ago, Jeffrey Curley, I always have him in my head, and I just don't, I can't, it's way too far of a reach for me to empathize with someone that does.
I don't think that empathizing means you condone their action.
I know.
Well, Michael had brought up earlier about, we didn't do it tonight, but continuing to work with Tom Lin practice.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason to view this current course of study as divorced from.
No, we're going to continue Tom Lin, we're going to continue it.
And so that's just that very question of when we practice Tom Lin, we can practice Tom Lin for the victim and also for the perpetrator. I mean, both are in serious, if you could say, need of assistance. Those people who are mixed up and going to commit violence are really in need of fundamental care and attention. So it's not, we're not talking about making judgments. We're not talking about accepting, okay. That's all. You're just simply taking it in, and you're realizing this is what it means to be really available to the world, that we're actually going beyond our own natural and instinctive response or reaction to something that we find utterly heinous or ghastly, and not because we're tuning a deaf ear to it at all, but simply because this is part of how we need to really work with our situations in ourselves and others. And it's difficult, there's no question. But I think that this is definitely one of the aspects we work on in our Tolman practice, for sure.
So is it clear that acceptance doesn't mean saying that that's okay?
That's right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's not what's meant here. Also, we are, although this book is not about training, okay? We just went through quite a bit of training in what we did previously, and we're only beginners in that. And our acceptance, including acceptance of love without limit to perpetrators as well as victims, to everyone without exception, which is the quality of Buddha. This is within all of us. That's a very important teaching. And the fact that we can't accomplish it right now simply means that we're in training. So, therefore, we should not feel bad that we can't, that at this point we say, this is my limit, I can't have compassion for so-and-so at this time. But you could keep in mind that your compassion could grow. And not accept, and you're not going to accept what's wrong. That's not what acceptance means. Yeah.
Confused at my volunteer job. A lot of people use, the homeless people use drugs. And I'll say to one of my coworkers who's much more knowledgeable and streetwise, although she is knowledgeable streetwise, not at all, but yeah, I say, oh, yeah, I think he's dealing. She says, oh, yeah, he told me he's using. And she has an enormous acceptance that everyone who uses deals.
Hmm.
You know, this is what you tell them, like, oh, there's no difference between the dealers and the users.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one guy who was in his 60s and, you know, loved his heroin and loved this and loved that, so I never sold a pill in my life. And I'm like, I don't believe that. You know, I know this guy has done all kinds of other stuff. But it's just, it's confusing, you know, the line between who's a perpetrator.
Oh, so the user is a victim and the dealer is the perpetrator?
Yeah, well, that's what you'd see.
And they're mixed.
You know,
you're saying they're mixed.
Yeah, but it isn't that clear.
Right? Victor and predator. Mm-hmm. Victim and predator, right.
Yeah. It's just all mixed up. People are both.
Because mm-hmm.
often predators or victims.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or I guess I see human beings, including myself, as I can be a predator. I don't hurt people. I mean, maybe other people are good all the time and don't ever hurt anybody, but I can. So I'm not, you know, I'm also a victim and a, you know, I can be hurtful.
Hurting yourself counts.
Mm-hmm.
Hurting yourself counts.
The same thing is true for abusiveness, sexual abuse and all that. Most people who are abusers have been abused.
Oh, yes.
This is actually
sure,
yeah.
So you begin to see how it's all part of a single a totality. It's a single.
But it's, you know, each of us is both.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like when I was talking to Michael Levin about, what's pure joy and what's not pure joy. Well, I'm trying to help people at the day center who are homeless. So I do it for selfish reasons. For me, it's very self, you know, helps me.
Maybe.
But you were saying it's both. It's both, you know, pure and impure.
There's more than that in you.
Yeah, that it's not just, oh, it's a klesha or it's not a klesha. It's pure joy or it's a klesha. You know, I mean, it's a mix. But it's a mix.
It's both and.
It's helpful to me. What?
Mm-hmm. We both and, not even.
Yeah, it's both and. It's not just
pure, oh, this is pure joy. I mean, I hug my five-year-old great-nephew, and it's, you know, selfish. I can just love to hold him, but it's also, you know, not selfish. So it's,
well, why would it be selfish of him?
Well, what's wrong with it being selfish? What's,
wrong with it's making it's just, you know, if you're going to say what's, you know, self, you know.
It's painful. I mean, back to that emotion of pain.
Yeah, well,
there is a judgment.
Pain that I can't see him more often. But anyway, I like that it's mixed. The perpetrator and the victim are the same person, and it's all of us.
So you're holding this child, and this is great, and there's great joy in this. But if someone took the child away and you felt miffed, then there's something a little impure about your approach.
Well,
you see, and that's true of all of us. That is, things are mixed and they change from 1/60th of a second to another. Mm-hmm. And we're in training.
What does that mean? That you're never supposed to feel the joy because somebody could take it away?
No.
No, but it's not that the joy is not pure 100%. I mean, I get all upset because his mother does reject me a lot. You know, I got bounced to the curb, sort of. I used to be part of the A family, now I'm part of the chocolate family. I just like that it's mixed.
Are we at a point of rest? Okay. Then I think those chants are somewhere in a bag over there. Can we do without them, or do you want to find them? They're in the, I think they're in the blue bag, not my attaché case.
Blue bag.
Who needs them?
This one.
I think they're in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So we shall end in our standard, predictable way. Hold on to it if you want. Try to bring it.
I think John won.
By this merit may all attain perfect awakening, rising above all forces of negativity, going beyond the turbulence of birth, old age, sickness, and death. May all beings be free from the ocean of samsara.